Well, last week, Johnny did a fantastic job of kicking off a new series. And we're calling the new series The Pursuit of Happiness. And what we're doing is essentially contrasting basically our culture, our society, kind of the paradigm of happiness, which I don't think we need to spell out too much, just in terms of success, comfort, security. And then embedded in the middle of Jesus' teachings, he has this series where he talks about happiness and his revolutionary model of happiness. And so it's oxymoronic throughout the whole set of teachings. He's really trying to disturb and have us think. And I think what I find most challenging about these teachings is Jesus drops these statements, right? That on the surface level, you're like, what? And then he doesn't explain it. And for centuries now, then the community needs to talk and pray and imagine and just to say, what does that look like then for us to live this out? So what I want to do just to get us started is I'll have us read through the entire set of teachings. And then I'll break you guys into, you know, groups. And just to discuss, we're going to be in the second one. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. What do you think that means? And then I'm going to show a clip from Australia where they interviewed some people in the street. But why don't we start and let's read through the beginning, the entire teaching first, and then I'll break us into discussion groups. So I think we have it on the screen, the Beatitudes. Go ahead and read. Go. All right. So we'll be in the second one. And what I want to do, I'm going to read it in the NIV first. And then I want to reread it in Eugene Peterson's translation just to give us a different angle. And then you all can discuss what you think it means. This is what the NIV says. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And Eugene Peterson translates it like this. You're blessed when you feel you've lost what's most dear to you, only then can you be embraced by the one most dear to you. So why don't you guys just maybe turn to someone next to you and just discuss, what do you think that means? How are you blessed when you're mourning? For you'll be comforted. All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. Go. All right. Any thoughts just initially before we jump into this? What do you guys think that means? Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Any thoughts? Okay. Yeah, so that you sometimes gain something by the absence of something and realizing you can do without it. Kind of. Okay, good. Anybody else? Okay, that... Like desperation kind of draws us to God that otherwise we wouldn't, kind of like that. Okay, great. This is what some folks in Australia thought. So. Oh, there's a clip in there. No? All right, picture Australian people with fancy accents saying profound things. Is it going to work? No. Okay. Well, there would have been a clip that was fantastic. But let's jump in, okay? So it starts out with this idea of blessed, and I think Johnny did a great job last week of unpacking that. And I want to take a little bit of a different angle. And what's great about how challenging these teachings are, right? Because Jesus just drops these statements, doesn't explain it. So you have thousands of years of commentary about these really simple statements. So there's dialogue and debate about what blessed means. And Eugene Peterson actually teaches and writes on this and expands on it. And he says, when we think of blessed, usually we think of it in a spiritual context, right? Kind of when the presence of God is with you, the hand of God is there, then you're blessed, whatever that looks like. But he said, there's another nuance to this word that he thinks is really important. And he said, the only English word that probably captures this well is the word lucky. And he says in this luckiness, there's two parts of it. So he says the first part, there's this sense that you have no control over it. And he was teaching this at Regent in Vancouver. And one of his students came up to him and said that in her church culture, they're not actually even allowed to use the word lucky when it comes to spiritual things. Because you have the sense like you're at a, you know, craps table or like you're associated with gambling. So in her church culture, they couldn't even call potlucks. They called them pot blessings. That's pretty awesome, right? But there's that idea, even in a potluck, right? It's like a gamble. So you're at home, you cook, you put veggie, spice, and then you bring your dish, and you don't know, you might have the best dish, you might have the crappiest dish. You show up, you know, if you see Pete Tam's car in the parking lot, you're like, yes, right? And there's that sense that you don't have control, and you gain something really amazing. And he says that word blessed has that element to it. Or I don't know if you've been to sporting events, and at halftime, sometimes they have entertainment, they try to bring in the crowd. And so at basketball games, sometimes they'll have people shoot a half-court shot, which is like 99% luck and maybe 1% skill. And I saw this one clip where they eliminated all skill, complete luck, by they blindfolded a guy. But it was actually pretty awesome. So in Utah, this happened. They blindfolded the guy. They said it was a random drawing. They picked this guy down, and then they sent him out of the stadium. While he was out of the stadium, they announced to everyone, we're going to pull a prank on this guy. So when he shoots the shot blindfolded, when the mascot sticks up his arms, everybody cheer as loud as you can. So check out the clip. So he was actually showing the choking sign to Reggie Miller. He was talking trash to him. And then he runs around the court. He's like dancing and celebrating. That's pretty awesome and cruel. But there's that sense, like minus the hoax and the prank, right? That sense that if he actually made the basket, that sense of like elation, that sense I didn't do anything to deserve this. Blessed. That's what Jesus is trying to capture. And then Eugene Peterson is, not only do we not have control over it, he said that there's this element of surprise. Growing up, one of my favorite childhood memories with my father was him playing hide and seek with us. And he was really good at it. I think he took it seriously. It was like a craft. So there was this one time, it was me and Rachel trying to find him. He's like, okay, mom's gone. Let's play hide and seek. We're like, yay. So he's like, all right, count to 30. Okay, we count to 30. And then so the first thing we do is we run upstairs. We're looking for him. And then when we come downstairs, we're looking in the bedrooms, under the beds, under the sheets, closets, nothing. We come downstairs, he's turned off all the lights. We're like, oh. So we grab flashlights and we're running around that house. And then we go down to the basement. Then it gets really scary. It's like musty and dark and these like beams of light. We're trying to find our dad. Okay. An hour later, we still don't find him. We give up. We're like, ah, whatever. So we start watching TV. But my father's so committed to his craft, he doesn't come out. Okay. While we're watching TV, it dawns on us that what if dad's gone? Like, what if he's disappeared? And so we start trying to find him again. And he found this one spot that was so good. It's pretty brilliant, actually. So if you grew up with a dining room table, So he hid under the dining room table. Okay. But dining room tables have dining room chairs that are pulled in. Okay. So on a dining room table, there's a tablecloth covering it. Dining room chair is pulled in. He now hides on top of the chair covered by the cloth. And we're, okay, at this point, we were a little bit scared already. We're like, I don't know if I can take care of you, Rachel. What if Dad's gone? What are we going to do? And so we're like crouching around the dining room table. We're like looking. We're like, he's not here. And then suddenly two arms come from the chairs and they grab us. We're like, ah! And there's this sense of like joy, surprise, fun, terror. So I've tried to instill this on my children. I am not as good. I like to think that it's not a level of skill, but the size of the house. But I've added a spiritual element to mine. My kids were in this camp where they had this lesson, and I guess the lesson was God's word is surprising. So my new thing, every day I find a way to like scare the crap out of them. So I'll be hiding behind a door. They're just, you know, Noah's got his thumb in his, you know, mouth with his blankie. He's going to bed. And I just jump up from behind the door. I'm like, God's word is surprising, right? I do that like two or three times a day. It's quite fantastic. So there's the sense of surprise, right? That we don't deserve it. And so when Eugene Peterson actually writes about this, he says, lucky are those who are poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Lucky are those who mourn. Okay? So we come to the mourning part of it, and this is where the oxymoron comes in, right? You're like, okay, I want to be lucky. I want to be surprised, right? I want to go through life when life seems like it's so disappointing and hard and lonely, and that there is this surprise that maybe all things do work out for the good of those who love him. Maybe there's this sense that as things aren't making sense, there's a surprise that's coming. So we like that, but then we come to this point where it says, blessed are you who mourn. A synonym would be the sense of lament. What commentators say is that this word is written, it's a participle. So the significance of the way the word mourning is written is that Jesus in saying, blessed are those who have mourned in the past, and now they're finished mourning, and then now it's like, surprise, everything's great, right? It's not like that, nor is it blessed are those who one day will mourn. The way he's saying it as a participle is that there's mourning that exists in this world. It's present. That a big part of this world is the loss of God, the loss of hope, the loss of love, the loss of a community, and that there's loss and mourning. And what Jesus is saying is we're blessed, we're lucky when we connect to what's already there, when we're willing to acknowledge it, when we're willing to legitimize it. And then a lot of commentators say this, we have to differentiate now between mourning and pessimism and mourning and optimism. And I think this is interesting. Maybe a way to say it is like this. I have a lot of friends who hate the church, good friends with them. And I would say 90% of my friends respond to that with pessimism. They're sitting at home, hanging out on a Sunday morning. They believe in God. They believe in Jesus. They just don't believe in the church. So when I tell them, well, we should create communities and what we're trying to do, they're like, well, it's never going to work, right? I've been part of communities like that. You know, it's idealistic. People get hurt. It's going to fall apart. So it's easier for me just to hang out at home and then have brunch, okay? That's a response of pessimism, okay? It's passive. It's inactive, okay? A response of pure optimism would be like, well, you know, the church is fine. Rejoice in the Lord always. Let's just whatever. And this sense of mourning then would be we long and we mourn for the loss of the church in Acts. We long and mourn for the loss of God's work in this world through a community of people. And then so in that mourning, we'll sit with it and we'll understand it. And then out of that mourning, we create something beautiful. So it's not pessimism. It's not optimism. There's a professor. He teaches at Duke Divinity. His name is Emmanuel Kantange. And he formed his theology and he calls it theology of lament during the Rwanda genocide in the mid-90s. And he has this book called Reconciling All Things. And he talks a lot about what is really wrong with the church in America is its shallow optimism. And I'll show you a clip in a second just to give you a taste of this is what formed his theology. These are just some quotes I wrote down when he was lecturing early in the spring when I heard him speak. He said, Christianity is the official religion of the officially optimistic. He says, the effect is we now live superficial lives. We don't know how to live when we're not laughing, so we pretend. We cannot contemplate a different world of endless progress, success, happiness. And so the challenge to the church then is our numbness. And he says, numbness doesn't kill. But he says, like despair, it robs us of our capacity to imagine, to see, to dream of a different world. He says, we live in a world of optimism that is devoid of hope. And he writes about that. He speaks on that. And this is the context that he formed his theology in.
Ten years ago, in the small East African country of Rwanda, 800,000 people were slaughtered by their own government.
This was ordinary men, women, and children, and the only reason that they were killed was because they were Tutsi.
Virtually the entire world turned away and did almost nothing to stop the genocide.
In retrospect, it all looks very clear, but at the time, what was happening in Rwanda, the situation was unclear.
They cannot tell me that they didn't know. Everybody knew what was happening.
Tonight on Frontline, the full story of perhaps the darkest and most brutal tragedy of our time. It is a story told by the victims and by the killers, by those who turned away and by those who stayed and tried desperately to save as many people as they could.
By the time the genocide was over, I was sweating. At America. America, the beautiful, America, the brave.
They are all still haunted by what happened.
I was the commander, and hundreds of thousands of people died. I can't find any solace in statements like I did my best.
Still haunted by the ghosts of Rwanda.
And that's a documentary that was done by PBS, and you can actually stream it on YouTube if you're interested. Okay, so that's the context, and now he writes about the importance, he calls it the discipline of lament, the discipline of mourning, and I'll just quote him because I can't articulate it any better. He says, the problem, one of many, is such an attempt to provide a quick fix for Rwanda does not sufficiently own or deal with the past. And he's responding to something Rick Warren, who's a pastor on the West Coast, what he said. He said, thus, Rick Warren's advice to pastors, if the devil gives you a problem about your past, remind him of the future, falls far short of a desperate need for Rwanda and all Christians to recognize the role they played in the story of genocide. He says, however, Rick Warren is not alone in this desire for a quick fix. The similar posture of reconstruction without memory characterizes many forms of Christian mission. NGOs who genuinely want to make a difference in Africa. He says, in this way, one does not face the fact that the Christian story and mission might be part of the problem. By not owning and engaging the past as part of the Christian story, one might easily think that Christian mission only brings to Africa good news, Easter, resurrection. It says, now cultivating a discipline of lament, of mourning, is thus a way to reestablish a link between a hope for the future and the memory of a painful past, a past which Christians must learn to name as our past and whose pain we can claim as our pain, not simply because we are its victims, but its perpetrators. And he's talking specific to the church in Rwanda and also to the global church who ignored this genocide when it was happening. Lament thus cultivates the anger necessary to see it that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way the Christian story has been conscripted in the performance of revenge. It is thus through lament that one may begin to appreciate the extent to which violence and revenge and retaliation has become a seductive temptation and a powerful spell for Christians. And I think you could take that same statement with global issues, and I think you could apply it to our own personal lives, of ways we've been hurt, of things that we mourn, things that we mourn the loss of. I'll read it again. It is thus through lament, through mourning, that one may be able to appreciate the extent to which violence, revenge, retaliation has become the seductive temptation and a powerful spell for Christians. Okay? So at this point, basically what he's saying is mourning is a healthier, better response than just optimism. Okay? So at this point, maybe you'll say, okay, I don't know if I agree with that, right? I don't know if I agree with this African theologian. Let's try Solomon. This is what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is the house of pleasure. Okay, so I know this is a pretty big concept, and I'm kind of hitting it at a pretty cognitive level. And hopefully, maybe during neighborhoods, we can unpack this a little bit more and say, okay, that's a great idea. So what does that mean? What does that look like? And I'll just offer what Emmanuel Kantange offers as steps for the discipline of lament. He says, maybe if we want to say, okay, what does that look like then? If mourning is good, lament is good. He says, relocation, step one. He says, unlearning distance. So whether it's our own pain or someone else's pain, to be willing to relocate ourselves into the pain. Then he says, step two, weeping. He says, unlearning numbness, to be willing to cry and weep and to allow people to weep. Then he says, urgency, that out of the weeping, to construct something, to form something. And then he says, community, step four, community, unlearning privatization. And then out of that, to become communities that hold both lament and worship together, that there is hope. There's imagination for a better future, but that there's a world of loss. There's a world of mourning. Okay. So I kind of just glossed over it and left these big kind of ideas, but you know, chew it, let it sit, let it percolate a little bit. Okay. And then he comes to this last part then. You're lucky, right? There's this sense of surprise if you mourn. For you will be comforted. And then what commentators say is this word comfort, grammatically, it's not in a passive voice, which means that it's not that we're being comforted, nor is it in an active voice where we're the ones comforting. What commentators say, it's actually in a middle voice where there's this sense of both, that somehow we can only be the ones comforting when we are comforted. Or another commentator say, we don't fully realize the benefits of being comforted until we actually engage the comfort. And that somehow it's a participatory thing, that in our mourning then, we run to God as Father. And there's an experience of while we engage and while we give. Maybe I'll give you a couple examples. I have two boys, Joshua and Noah, 10 and 6. A couple weeks ago, their cousin Zachary was sleeping over. And so the three of them are in one room. Okay, so they spent a week together, the bunk bed, Zachary's on the couch. So one night, I don't remember what happened. Noah was doing something where before we went to bed, we had to kind of discipline him. I think they were just getting a little rowdy, okay? So they went to sleep. Karen and I were putzing around for a couple more hours. We were in bed, ready to go to sleep. Lights were off, and then we hear this door open, and then we hear like the pitter-patter of little footsteps, like, and then our door swings open. And then it's dark, so we can't really see anything, but we hear sniffling. And then we were like, Noah? And he's like, yes. And he comes running into bed. And so we go, what's wrong, Noah? What's wrong? And then it turns out he'd had a dream. He told us that Zachary was hurt, so he was crying. So we ran over to check on Zachary. Zachary's fine. And so clearly he was dreaming, okay? So at this point, as a father, this is how I respond. Turn on the light, pour some cold water in his face, just slap him a couple times. I'm like, wake up, Brett, wake up. Okay, first of all, you're 6 years old, so suck it up. And then secondly, this is a dream. It's not even reality, right? Don't cry, wake up, and just start shaking him, right? No, I didn't do that. I could have done that. I could have tried to fix it immediately. I could have said, okay, daddy's got your back. Next time you have this dream, I will enter into the dream. What's that called when you can control your dreams? Huh? Yeah, Inception. No, what's the one where you like, you know you're dreaming? Lucid dreaming, right? So daddy can lucid dream. I will control my dream to save your dream, right? I could have done that. But you know what our response was? He was just confused and really scared. And we just brought him into our bed. And we held him. And we shushed him and quieted him until he was comforted. And he went to sleep. And then mom fell asleep. And then dad fell asleep. And there's this sense in scripture that as we mourn personal loss, and I know that there's those of us in this room who are dealing with that, where you wake up and you're dealing with this overwhelming sense of loneliness. Or there's others of us who've lost something, a marriage, a friend, a parent. And there's this sense of hurt and pain. You know, there's others of us who are maybe in this place where there's things that are kind of down, but we're just numb. We can't even remember the last time we wept or cried. And so this morning, instead of trying to explain this all and to have us grasp it cognitively, I thought maybe we could spend some time just reflecting and meditating, and to come to that place where either it's our own personal sense of loss or mourning, or maybe there's global injustice, and to stand in that place, or we have dear friends who are really going through something that we can't even fix or articulate, and to be in that place with them. And so as we close this morning, I'd like to ask all of you to, if you can close your eyes but engage. If you feel like you're going to close your eyes and disengage, keep your eyes open, just look down. And we're going to spend some time just praying and meditating and ask for the comfort of God to be with us. And so if you guys could right now, just kind of get yourself into that place. And whatever it is, whether it's your own personal struggle or it's the struggle of someone you know, and this is what Dietrich Bonhoeffer says. He says, we are the crucified. We stand as strangers in the power of him who was so alien to the world that crucified him. He says, this is our comfort, or rather, he is our comfort, our comforter. And we as the church are the alien community that is comforted by the cross. Flora Wilner says this: it is not enough for us within the arena of the world's pain to merely know of a God who sympathizes. It is not even enough to know of a God who heals. We need to know of and be connected with a God who experiences with us, for us, each grief, each wound. We need to be bonded with a God who has nails in his hands and nails in his feet, hung on a cross. And I'll just give you some time to come to that place of that sense of loss, or the sense of your friend's loss, or the world's loss. And as we're there, that we don't try to do or fix or earn. And just to know that God is with us. He's Emmanuel. For us to imagine when, you know, Elijah was in that cave suicidal. And God, you know, comes not in this powerful wind or in an earthquake or a fire, but after all that comes a gentle whisper. And to allow God to come in that whisper. Eugene Peterson writes in this poem, "Blessed are those who mourn. Flash floods of tears, torrents of them. Erode cruel canyons, exposing long forgotten strata of life laid down in the peaceful decades. A bad lands of beauty. The same sun that decorates each day with colors, from arroyos to mesas, also shows every old scar and cut of lament. Weeping washes the wounds clean and leaves them to heal, which always take an age or two. No pain is ugly in the past tense. Under the mercy, every hurt is a fossil, link in the chain of becoming, pick and shovel prayers often, turn them up in the valleys of death."